This show is sponsored by Qualitest. Deploy software that you and your customers trust with Qualitest Testing and Business Assurance Services. Learn more about Qualitest at qualitestgroup.com. Welcome to The Testing Show. I'm Michael Larson, the show producer, and this morning we are joined by Justin Rohrman.
Good morning.
Perzi Ababa.
Good morning, everyone.
Our special guest, Alan Page.
Good morning.
And, of course, our MC, Mr. Matt Heuser. Take it away, Matt.
Thank you, Michael, and welcome to the show, everyone. I hope you're having a good week so far. And we've got a ton to cover today. We want to talk about some of the things happening in tester land, some of the things happening in general software delivery, then talk about Microsoft and what Alan has been doing with concurrent engineering there. So let's start with the news segment. Perzi, you had a story out of Lockheed Martin?
Yes. I was going through randomly in Twitter yesterday and found this rather interesting news where there was a report out of the Air Force were saying that there's a bunch of Lockheed Martin employees were informed due to a database crash that happened, I believe it's a week ago. The cause really was just, hey, the database crashed and there's no more data. And what was really affected was it's a system that tracks, you know, ongoing investigations and inquiries. So there's apparently over 100,000 records that was affected because of this. As of today, I believe they're still looking for ways to see if they can recover some of that data or even asking people around if they have backup in other locations. That's really very surprising to me that a group supposedly as important as the Air Force has really dropped the ball in this one. I mean, what do you guys think?
Oh, if I was a conspiracy theorist, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it's posts like this that just make you step back and go, seriously?
Are the backups on a conspicuous politician's email servers? Womp womp, that was a bad joke. So do they try to use the backup files and they just didn't work? Like, what happened there?
I don't think there's even any reference to an active recovery from a given backup. It just seems to me that there's no backup at all. They were trying to recover it from the database that crashed, but they are having problems with it.
Which sounds to me like there either was no backup or backup was so old to be unusable. Or, to be fair and to give a little bit of benefit of the doubt, it is entirely possible that a change to a system can happen that somebody didn't test, where when you go back to actually restore a backup, because something in the database doesn't map the same way that the original backup that was made did, you can find yourself in a situation where the backup doesn't work anymore. I've actually seen that happen. I've done a test where we were testing backup and restore. A change had been made to backup, and we were verifying that different system configurations were able to do a backup. And yeah, that all worked. Okay, oh, by the way, let's make sure that we can restore this. Crunch. Ooh, that's not good. Call me kooky if you're going to be testing a change to backup, restore and verify you can get up and running again? Or am I being silly?
There's a couple of really bizarre things about this. One being, as Perzi pointed out, the article indicates that backups were taken and they can't do anything with them. The amount of money that is being spent every day on these kinds of projects, you could hire a programmer and they could take the CSV and they could write SQL statements and they could re-import it. You're going to have some data. If it's a relational database management system and it crashed, and it probably is because it's using FOIA requests and those didn't exist prior to around 1999, and the system crashes, then you turn it back on, you lose one day's data. That's what happens.
That's a good point. All those backups usually go back in time like 12 or 24 hours. So they should have stacks and stacks of tapes or whatever they use now.
Well, my concern with the backups is that it's not in the right format to actually restore, which you'd have to hire a programmer to go write a for loop to go do an import. Even the database itself, so it crashed. I mean, I guess the hard drive is bad, then you have to hire a hard drive recovery specialist to go pull the files. But
I have a hard time believing that there were no recoverable backups and the database is on one hard drive. Today, I just don't believe that non-redundancy is an issue. And I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, but this is a press release statement over some larger story, which may not be exciting X-Files stuff. Still, knowing software, this is a nice story for our parents to read and go, oh, the database crashed, they lost stuff. But because we know about software, there's a lot more to this story. And it may be totally uninteresting, or it may be a conspiracy theory, or maybe somewhere in between. But the story is some nice fluff that's just not giving us all the detail.
So there's an interesting corollary to this. So this is about whistleblowers of waste, fraud, and abuse and Freedom of Information Act requests. There was an article in the Washington Post, I want to say it was about a month ago, about an executive in the IG's office for the FBI, but it was his job to protect whistleblowers. And we'll be able to find this because his grandfather had actually stopped Hitler in what was the beer hall putsch. So the first time Hitler tried to rise to power, he tried to organize a revolution in a beer hall, and a couple of loyal German army officers stood up and raised their pistols and said, "No, you're not doing that," and put him in jail. That guy's grandfather was working for the Inspector General's Office of the FBI, and it was his job to protect whistleblowers. And he was eventually fired and investigated himself for doing his job. Because they're trying to go through back doors and just arrest the whistleblowers for all kinds of ridiculous stuff and drive them out of society. Snowden knew about this. So when the claims were made that Edward Snowden should have followed channels, he actually knew that channels didn't work. And given that this is a database that contains all of that data, it just raises more questions. And I have to agree with Alan, it just doesn't make any sense. One positive thing I can say, if this is positive, I did a consulting assignment with Lockheed Martin in 2012. The non-disclosure agreement has ended, and I think I'm comfortable saying in public, they have a wide variety of skill level on their teams. So incompetence is it's a possible answer. We should probably move on from general software world to tester world with this Twitter thread with Noah Sussman that has happened over the past couple of days. Michael, do you want to talk about that?
Oh, sure. This seems to be a common occurrence. And first off, I communicate with Noah on various things, and I like a lot of what Noah does and what he talks about. What we're ultimately coming down to is a statement that is made that ends up getting turned into hyperbole. Gee, on Twitter, that never happens. The biggest factor here is the idea that if you are CDT or if you are testing, that you are anti-automation. And I think that we've proven time and time again that, generally speaking, we're not anti-automation. In fact, I couldn't do my job without automation. What tends to come into play, though, is that there's an interpretation that because we say that automation is a tool, that automation helps you do other things, it opens it up to the possibility that you can work on other stuff, that somehow that is an interpretation of automation is bad. And that's the way that the spin has been rolling with this. And again, I'm not trying to impugn Noah. I think Noah makes some great points. I think the fact is that automation does a lot of good stuff for us. Automation has saved me from a ton of drudgery, especially in my peripheral role as a release manager and doing machine setup so that I can actually do the releases. If I had to do all of that on my own or actually test that out on my own, I'd never get a release out. So I am not, by any stretch of the imagination, anti-automation. It's not that I don't think automation has a definite place in checking and verification and validation and such. It's just that automation, I believe it is a tool that is useful for certain things. It's useful for a lot of things. But there are also areas where automation has to go through some manual exploratory and learning before it can be even implemented and then made helpful.
I have a slightly different take on that. My feeling is that Noah and other people in programmer-heavy testing roles like that see the massive body of work from the CDT community where we have this kind of special way of taking an extremely critical eye at everything. And it's always front-loaded with, here's the parts that are crap. This is what you don't want to do, instead of, here are my success stories.
If I can jump in here with a shameless plug, I have an ebook out called The A Word, Stories About Automation, which is, it's a bunch of essays on ways that automation generally doesn't work or can work. You could say I live on the edge of the CDT community. I don't consider myself a member, but I'm obviously context-driven. When I hear people speak out against automation, they're speaking out against the stupid ways you can do automation, thinking that everything can be automated or betting the company on some brand new GUI automation tool. I think we often throw the baby out with the bathwater, we being the general test community, saying automation may be bad in this situation, but it's not. And I agree with everything that Michael said. I think automation used correctly, very helpful, saves you from boredom, saves a lot of time. But I think when we fall into the extremes of let's use automation for everything, or let's use this GUI automation tool to solve all of our problems and solve world peace, is where we fall into traps.
The other part of the equation is they speak a slightly different language, or they, meaning Noah and the other people who feel that way. They speak a slightly different language than we do. The CDT people, or people who self-identify in that way, have mostly accepted the words that come from Bach and Bolton, like check and test and things of this nature. He refuses to acknowledge those for whatever reason. He may have perfectly valid reasons. And when people approach the problems using those words, he's like, whatever, don't care. I'm already doing something that works.
Honestly, if I can jump in, those words are a turnoff for me too.
I tend to agree, and I think Justin really hit on something strong, in that if you go after someone who knows what they're doing isn't working and they feel kind of awkward and embarrassed about it, and you come in as the expert and you have this special language that actually helps them differentiate what's going wrong, you can be very helpful and it works. But when you talk to someone who is succeeding anyway before they ever met you and they're doing just fine, you're going to have a lot of conflict when you come up and say, no, you're using the wrong word. When we put ourselves out there in public, that kind of criticism, especially when you're succeeding, it doesn't seem particularly helpful. It took me about 2 years to say, yeah, I think the testing checking distinction is helpful. It's worth making, but I try to do it with a soft touch. I found the actual tweet that started it all off. And what Noah said was, the majority of voices in the testing community are trashing automation. Fine then, stop complaining when no one wants to hire you, which I thought was kind of a firebrand comment. He kind of has a point, but in the general software community, I do see a lot of people saying, I just want to push a button, get a cup of coffee, and come back with a green bar, and completely eliminate any human investigation into risk. I think that's naive and crazy for lots of reasons, but maybe eliminating the regression test phase as a phase is a reasonable thing, and there are lots of little things you can do to help that happen.
It's a question of value, really, right? I mean, when you are in a given context, for example, you don't go in guns blazing and say, we can't use automation here. That should be your primary salvo. But based on our understanding of how we deliver software or how we build software, we can definitely identify the areas where automation can help. In my world, continuous delivery with static analysis and all that good stuff is definitely part of that, because there's a question of skill from the developers, from the code reviewer perspective, where there's been so many things that have been missed, even though they declared that this particular feature is done. But I still have a lot of questions, and I will get to talk to Noah face-to-face next week for the NYC Testers Meetup. I do question his tweet. I still don't understand who refers to as the majority, what he used for counting. I do have a lot of questions, but if you're one of those Luddites where we just say no automation, because yeah, humans are so much better, I don't know if there's a place for that in the way we deliver software.
The big thing that I have is, where do we start? And if you Google software test automation, how do I do it? You're likely to get either test-driven development, which I think is a good start. Let's get the code in better quality before it gets to test. Or record playback-y, GUI stuff. And usually when I come in on a consulting assignment, I say things like, let's start with continuous integration. Let's start with virtual servers that you can do on demand. Let's start with radically decreasing the commit to testable build time. How do we do that? Those are the things that I am much more interested in automating than a typical consulting assignment. And the other things come later. So maybe I come off that way. There's also an article by Kaner that we could link to. It's a blog post. I'm sure some of you have read it, where he did a workshop a while back. And there were some attendees at the last workshop on teaching software testing that said they were not interested in automation and didn't want to talk about it. He took some issue with that.
I also think we're dealing with a false equivalency here. I'm intimately familiar with the huge benefits that automation provides. If you think that I'm doing all of those steps manually every single time the same way, you're crazy. Of course I'm going to write a script to help me do that. As I've mentioned multiple times on this, if you take a bunch of commands and put it in a script and run them at the same time, guess what? You're doing automation, so come on.
I think that we in this room, we have a view of automation, which I think correct is the wrong word, but I think it's perhaps a minority. And there's a lot of generalization in this tweet stream and even in this conversation we're having around good automation versus bad automation. Matt was talking about a lot of people just want to see their test turn green and that's good enough. And I think, well, that's idiotic. If that was automation, I would come out and say automation is bad. Those of us that have done it and sort of get it, and Noah definitely gets it And NOAA definitely sees people speaking out against automation. But I think the disconnect is, again, I'll replug the A word. I speak out against bad automation. There is a lot of bad automation, meaning the approach is bad. The goals are bad. There's tolerance for flaky tests, et cetera. There's all kinds of ways to screw up automation. But there's also all kinds of ways to use it to make your job so much easier and so much more effective. So I think when you're speaking in generalizations, you can say, look at the bad automation and say, yeah, automation is bad. We shouldn't do it because this is stupid. It's wasting time. Or you can look at it and go, I couldn't do my job without automation. But I'm not NOAA. I actually talked to NOAA last night. But I feel like there is some background where a statement came from. I can't agree with where the majority came from. But there are a lot of voices speaking out against automation, but I feel like they're speaking out against the stupid automation, throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
It's probably fair to say that that sort of nuanced, advanced view is pretty darn hard to communicate on Twitter and may often come off as opposed to. I think we've probably taken this conversation as far as we can without getting NOAA on the phone, so we've got to get him on the show. So speaking of having on the show, we've got Alan Page from Microsoft, formerly Director of Microsoft Engineering Excellence, and is still a happy, proud technical person, right? You're a contributor on a project right now.
Still employed. Last Monday was my 21-year anniversary of Microsoft.
Wow.
Yeah, which is crazy, right? Because it means I'm old.
Congratulations, Alan. Yeah.
We should also mention, and Alan is one of the voices of the A-B testing podcast, and two of the three who happen to listen to the podcast happen to be here on the show today. So I'm just going to make that point.
Exciting to be here. I'm the A half of A-B testing, and I will tell Brent you said hello.
Awesome.
That's cute. Alan and Brent, A-B testing.
You just figured that out?
Yeah. No, I'm telling my audience.
Oh, okay.
I met Alan at Star East probably 2010. He's been around. I think he was given a keynote then. I think he might have been on the old Twist show, actually. So we've known each other a long time. It's good to see someone that's sort of been around. And specifically, Alan was involved in this transition Microsoft has gone through where they used to have a separate and distinct testing group that was kind of a peer to development. And now they're doing something they call concurrent engineering. So yeah. Tell us a little bit about concurrent engineering, Alan.
Internally, they call it combined engineering, which I hate. I don't like the term. I prefer unified engineering or concurrent engineering is fine. The transition is that sort of came out of necessity in some cases. Some cases, the change came about sort of like, oh, I think this would be cool. One thing I can say, it's hard to generalize about all of Microsoft when we have, 45,000 engineers or so, is that I don't think we have anyone in a test title anymore as a full-time employee. We had, at our peak, I don't think we ever went over, but we were really close to 10,000 testers across the company, which was a lot. I think overall it was like 1.2 dev to one tester across the company, so a pretty high ratio. And then one by one, especially as more and more of the company began making cloud-based products, services, web apps, et cetera, those teams began to merge, meaning the developers and testers became one team. Done. In some teams, this was done very effectively. I like to think that the team I'm on is a very effective engineering team. We can talk about some of the reasons that works. And I can tell you about some of the places where teams have made this change and it has been very ineffective. In fact, I heard of one team at Microsoft, and I'm not naming them to be for anonymity. I'm not naming them because I can't remember which team, who are considering moving back and adding a separate team to their product. So that's going backward is at least an admission of defeat, not necessarily failure, but worth talking about some of the reasons why teams end up being successful or being unsuccessful in making a move like this.
Yeah, and I think that you hit on something big there in that if I understand it correctly, concurrent engineering isn't that different than embedding a tester in a multidisciplinary Scrum team. There are lots of skills, there's some overlap, the team has enough to deliver the product, but not everybody knows how to do everything.
Yeah, and that's absolutely critical because I'll jump right into where the teams where I've seen this fail, not just once, but repeatedly, dozens of times, is when they merge the former testers with the former developers and say, okay, now everybody owns quality. Furthermore, they assume everyone does the same thing from beginning to end. So everybody owns design, implementation, unit test, integration test, exploratory testing, etc. And those teams end up failing because some people actually can do it all. Those are generally people that are going to grow into your architects and very, you know, broad-minded systems thinking technical people. But good software teams aren't made up of a bunch of people that can all do the exact same thing. You need specialization. Generalizing specialists and specializing generalists are the core of making teams like this work. You need to realize the skills of the team and use those, orchestrate those people to work together and make good software. So when you have your typical agile team with some embedded testers, that's bringing test specialization. I don't expect those testers to implement features as well as do all the testing. And you don't want, another mistake I've seen is you embed testers on a team or former testers into an integrated team, and everybody shovels their stuff over to them to test. Where it works out better, and we can go into specifics of my team in a bit, but where that tends to work out better is where those test specialists, they do some exploratory testing and they make sure the holes in testing around ILDs, et cetera, are all covered. But more importantly, they do a lot of coaching and reviewing and pairing with the programmers on the team to make sure that they're writing quality code that is well tested. A lot of developers at Microsoft rarely, if ever, wrote unit tests, let alone functional tests. But that transition wasn't that tough. To think the programmers aren't good at writing unit tests or functional tests, think they can't do it, wrong. And in fact, having them do it, I've heard the argument that we don't want them to write those tests because they're too highly paid as programmers to spend their time, which is, you can laugh here if you want, but it's actually critical that developers write their own unit and functional tests, because what I've found in every case is that developers that do that tend to write simpler, more maintainable code in the first place because they have to think about how to test it from the very, very beginning. And that's true whether you're doing TDD or ATDD or whatever. Just testing your own code makes you write better code in the first place.
Yeah, I think that totally agree. As far as the unit level, and that's where if I have no context at all and someone says, where should we start test automation? I usually say unit test TDD because you have to be a consumer for your own API. You're like, that's really awkward and weird and hard to instantiate an object. Maybe I should change that before you actually write the code. That seems to be very powerful. So yeah. It seems like we, in terms of the button you can push that comes back with a green bar, or we're talking before we started about the PowerPoint that solves all your problems and it's just going to be like this. People kind of want easy answers. And I imagine when Microsoft converted from large department-based approach to integrated teams, there's a real desire for sort of cookie cutter. Every team should do it like this. Here are the roles. Here are the responsibilities. Go. And I'm hearing you say that it was a lot more complex than that, and teams did it differently.
It happened at different times. It wasn't like a corporate decree. Teams slowly made this transition. And anytime you're doing an organizational change, and I'll generalize first and I'll get some specifics. When you make an organizational change, explaining the why about it is really important. So some teams that failed, it's like testers, you're not developers, developers, you're not testers or whatever. Everybody's an engineer was the mantra. And then go. And all activities still need to happen. What you get from combined engineering is not double throughput. This reminds me of the article from like a year ago where the guy, tangent here, where the guy wrote, talking about pair programming, said it won't work because you have to hire twice as many developers. So back on topic here is the throughput isn't going to double. All the activities still need to happen. When you don't realize that, when you don't tell people why, you're going to be in trouble. The teams that have been successful, it's very clear why they're successful. They recognize that the back and forth ping pong game that we played for many years between developers and testers, where the developer says, here's my code, find the bugs. And the tester says, here, I found some bugs. And the developer says, thank you for finding my bugs. Here are some fixes for those. And the tester says, thank you very much for your fixes. Half of them are fixed, half of them aren't. Please take it back. And this goes back and forth and back and forth. And it's very inefficient. By reducing that loop to a developer's brain for the bulk of those things, you get a lot more efficiency side of development. And the reason you do that, going back to the why, is we're not shipping every 3 years anymore. Most products on Microsoft don't even ship every year. Most products, excluding like Windows, which even on the Insider program ships monthly, programs are shipping monthly, weekly, daily, which is, I don't know how you would do that on a phased or staged or predictive development model. So the teams understand why they're doing that. And then management supports the idea that all the activities still need to happen and testing still really important, whether I have someone dedicated specifically to that or not, are the teams that have been very successful at this.
Are you familiar with the work that Arlo Belshi was doing at Microsoft for a while?
Yeah.
So if he was coaching a team, and a lot of these, we're going to double productivity, doesn't really examine the starting place. So if the starting place is bad, sure, you can double productivity. But if Arlo was coaching a team that started off bad, I think I could see a doubling of productivity over time.
Oh, yeah, I'm not questioning productivity going up. What I'm questioning is I've made this organizational change. Now productivity goes up. There's the magic in the middle is missing.
Exactly. It's a question mark. You got to, like, there's going to be coaching and skill development and training and work involved. And initially, that's going to be an investment, which means you might actually slow down a little when you start, right? I mean, that's more realistic.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Teams need to figure out how to make this transition.
So tell me about a couple teams that some that did it better and some that.
So let me. It might be easier to talk about my team and how we work. So I was hired onto this team almost exactly a year ago to be the quality guy, air quote quality guy, on an engineering team. There are very few, if any, former testers on this team. But what my boss determined was that I have a bunch of developers who are cranking out code, but I need someone to sort of think about quality and testing end to end and make sure we're actually build a quality product despite ourselves. So that's been my role. So I've done a ton of coaching on writing unit tests. Our developers write unit tests, integration tests in Selenium or a web-based app. They've learned how to be pretty good testers up to a point. And then what I make sure is that things don't fall through the cracks on building a quality product. So it can be process things throughout engineering process. It can be, so I'm sort of that test specialist in a very large team rather than the embedded tester in a Scrum team. I'm the quality guy on a team of about 100 engineers. What I found is not all developers are these great testers, but a lot of developers, or a fair number of developers, actually are really good sort of systems thinking end-to-end testers. I don't do them often. We did a bug bash maybe 6 months ago. I think the VP requested that I do it, and I was kind of hemming and hawing, but we had a few people that found some just amazing bugs that I think any tester would be proud to have found themselves. So the fact that they can find those, just, oh, wait, these people that are programmers by day can be very good testers. Another thing I did, which has worked out really well, is I took all the illities, the things like globalization, security, performance, privacy, et cetera. Those things typically fall to a test team or a test specialist. I don't scale that well. So I put my peer engineering managers in charge of tracking and driving those things across the team, the same way like in the old world we'd have a test lead do. And they've done mostly very, very well in driving those areas across the product and getting improvements there. So my job is to make sure those things aren't forgotten and then to figure out how to get the engineering team, where there are no dedicated testers, to absorb those things and make them part of their job. And so far, so good. I like to think that the team I'm on is doing this pretty well. There are a lot of teams, and it would be perhaps a detriment to my 22nd year at Microsoft to mention them by name, but there are a lot of teams that those things have fallen off the radar. They have an engineering team, but they maybe don't give the illities the attention they used to get, or their development team don't really write a lot of testing beyond some very rudimentary unit tests, and then quality overall suffers.
Wow, so you're talking 100-1. Is that the future, a envisioned future of testing? Easily could be. We're more like architects and coaches that supervise the overall process and step in when we can and delegate than testers, because we've got to delegate because the ratio is going to flip. Is that?
I don't think 100-1 is the norm. I think 100-1 is something you get away with when you've done this for 21 years or 25 years, if I go back pre-Microsoft. And even there, I do, behind the curtain, there is some scale with some vendors that help with fill in the holes that the functional testing that the automation doesn't cover.
Hmm.
So there are a few testers hidden behind the curtain, but it's temp work.
Do they have to be on site?
No, they don't, actually.
Maybe we can talk later.
Matt's always looking for his angle.
Alan, I have a quick question for you. In a well-executed concurrent engineering context, how do you guys deal with bugs? What's your bug strategy, if you have one?
Find them and fix them. Find them, fix them, or punt them as a strategy.
So pretty much you're just, there's no bugs that are just sitting in the backlog for more than 30 days. Is that what the goal is, or is it less than 30
absolutely.
Days?
In fact, I can air dirty laundry because I don't mind doing it about my own team. I don't like talking about other teams with that amount of detail. But yeah, the goal is in fact, the rule now is there are no bugs older than 30 days. I actually prefer to have no bugs at all. Find them, fix them, or punt them. If they're bad, they'll come back. But we lost track of that for a while. That one, we had a backlog drift up a little bit. We have a handful of bugs older than 30 days, and those are now being taken care of promptly and closed. So until we get caught up a little bit on the backlog, our interim goal is no bugs older than 30 days. And our product is moving fast enough that so far what I find is any bug older than 30 days is obsolete anyway. So it's a combination with those old bugs. It's a combination of not just fixing them, just keeping on top of them and closing the ones that are obsolete. And we'll reel that in.
That's a great question, Percy. Anybody else have questions for Alan? I've talked a lot. Don't all go at once.
No, sounds like we're all intimidated, right? Maybe that's a thing.
I think we're good. Good stuff so far.
Got enough nuggets in there?
Oh, yeah. No, I think we're solid.
Yeah, once again, we let the news take up the time, but it seems like that was good for our energy. All right. Well, thanks for coming, Alan. I tell us about your podcast. Tell us about where people can read your stuff, see your stuff, learn more about what you're doing.
All right. The podcast is AB Testing. It's for Alan and Brent. And you can find us on iTunes and also on angryweasel.com/ABTesting. And then also angryweasel.com is where you'll find me occasionally writing on my blog, at Alan Page on Twitter. And if you want to see me live, I'll be somewhere near New York in November. I'm going to be speaking at Test Bash in Philadelphia and talking at much greater length and with many more details about a little bit about what we talked about today, which is the title of my talk is Testing Without Testers and Other Stupid Ideas That Sometimes Work.
That's a great title. And I have to say, having seen Alan a couple of times, you're a great mixture of a strong content speaker that also is entertaining and fun. And it's rare that you really get both, honestly, at a conference. And one of my issues lately is that we haven't had enough strong content speakers at some of these conferences. So
Go ahead. Yeah, I just say I'm excited to be there. Should be a fun time.
Yeah, I won't be able to make Test Bash Philly, but we're going to be all over. So in September is the month that's firming up for me right now. There's the Atlanta Quality Conference, STACK. There's KWSQA, and there's Anna Roisman's Quality Leadership Testing.
Testmasters.
Testmasters Academy. That's it. Testmasters Academy. It's all the same days. So right now we're looking at plane tickets. Can I get to one day and fly another one the next, and how are we going to make that work? I don't think I'm going to make STACK, but we'll get a list of other events in the show notes. And you've probably heard a lot about CAST if you listen to the show a lot. But give us one more teaser about CAST, Justin.
CAST 2016 in August in Vancouver, British Columbia this year. The theme is software testing as a development catalyst, how we help propel development forward and deliver better software faster.
All right, to give one more conference plug, I'm part of the group that's helping shape this, so I have a little bit of pride in this. 34th Annual Pacific Northwest Software Quality Conference is happening October 17th through 19th, 2016. It is happening in Portland, Oregon, and the theme this year is cultivating quality software. So if you are looking for a conference to attend and you are looking for something in the middle of October, PNSQC is a pretty darn good conference, if I do say so myself. And Alan and I have both presented at PNSQC. In fact, I think all of us, with the exception of Justin, have at some point presented there.
Yeah, so, I've not been to that conference yet. Should make it there one day.
I encourage it.
So Percy's presented at PNSQC?
No, I have not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We got to get you out there.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Well, you know, the cool thing you mentioned that is that I just got realigned to a new boss. And apparently he was invited to speak. So I'm actually helping him craft his slides and be his primary evaluator for his talk. So maybe I'll be there.
All right.
At the one in Portland, PNSQC?
Yep, that is correct.
Oh, that's awesome. That's a great coincidence. So one thing I will, you know, we try to recommend resources if you want to go deeper. There are some things in software that are becoming harder to determine if they're correct or oracles are failing us. For instance, recommendations on something like Amazon or an e-commerce engine or a tag cloud. And another one would be search engine results or big data systems. So the folks at Quality Test do have a blog post on how to test big data systems. We're going to link to it in the show notes. Tell us if you're interested in it. Email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com. And we can do more of that kind of thing, which I think is a great way for testers to add value, because when it is coded, how you figure out if it is fit for use is unclear. And that's the point where people realize they need help. And if we have answers, then maybe we have an opportunity to help them. And that's really all I have. Thanks, everybody, for coming today. Really appreciated it. I'll give Alan the last word.
The last word? Well, thank you. Hey, thanks for having me on the show. Great talking with you guys. Great talking about what's going on my team. And have a great rest of your day.
Awesome. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Alan.
Yeah.
All right. See you guys.
Thank you for listening to The Testing Show, sponsored by Qualitest. For more information, please see www.qualitestgroup.com. Do you have questions? Or is there a topic or an idea you'd like to have covered? Please email us at thetestingshow@qualitestgroup.com, and we will answer questions we receive on air.